This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Alyssa Blanc.
And I'm Robert Siegel. With Congress out of town for its July 4th break, President Obama sidestepped the Senate confirmation process to make several recess appointments today, including one that is very controversial. Pediatrician Donald Berwick is the new head of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services. As NPR's Julie Rovner reports, that has left Senate Republicans fuming.
White House Press Secretary Robert Gibbs was blunt in defending the appointment at his daily briefing this afternoon. He said Republicans in the Senate have been holding up too many nominations, and this post, heading up an agency that oversees hundreds of billions of dollars of federal spending each year, is too important to be left vacant.
The president is going to install people that need to be installed for this government to run effective and efficiently. In this case, because the appointments process is clearly broken, he did so through a recess appointment.
Besides, said Gibbs, there's little doubt that Berwick, a Harvard professor and founder of a health quality think tank, has broad base support for the job.
This is somebody who all involved say is uniquely qualified. The last two people who have run CMS for the Bush administration both strongly supported Dr. Berwick's appointment.
That's true. Berwick also has broad support from every corner of the healthcare industry, including doctors, nurses, consumers, hospitals, and even health insurers. Karen Ignani is president and CEO of America's Health Insurance Plans.
We've had a long relationship with Don Berwick. We have nothing but the utmost respect for his qualifications.
But there's one key group that's not so sure about Berwick's qualifications. Senate Republicans, including Wyoming's John Barrasso, have serious doubts about some of the things Berwick has written during his long career in academia. And Barrasso is among those senators who are furious the president has evaded their opposition by using his recess appointment authority. The senator was on his cell phone between meetings in rural Wyoming.
I think it is arrogant and irresponsible to go ahead and appoint someone as controversial as Dr. Berwick without ever having a single congressional hearing.
During Senate floor speeches since Berwick's nomination was announced in April, Barrasso and his Republican colleagues have repeatedly cited Berwick's praise for Britain's national health system and suggested he'd like to impose a similar system here.
Dr. Berwick has a long history with the British healthcare system, and it's a system that saves money by denying care to people in need of care.
But Chris Jennings, a senior health policy advisor to President Clinton, says what Republicans really want has less to do with Berwick and more to do with whoever President Obama might have nominated for the key Medicare-Medicaid post.
The desire of many, perhaps not all Republicans, is to continue the debate that has already been settled. They wish to relitigate the legislative battle that took place last year and the beginning of this year.
In other words, they want to keep the battle over the health care law alive, and whoever heads the Medicare-Medicaid agency will have a significant say over how that law is implemented. With the recess appointment, Berwick can now lead the agency until the end of 2011. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
In addition to Dr. Berwick, President Obama made two other recess appointments today. Former Assistant Secretary of Defense Philip Coyle is now Associate Director for National Security and International Affairs. That's in the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy. And former Assistant Secretary of the Treasury Joshua Gottbaum can start work as the new director of the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation. That's the agency that protects pensions for more than 44 million workers and retirees. A year and a half into his term, Mr. Obama has more than 180 nominees still pending before the Senate.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. Some good economic news from the White House today. President Obama's push to boost exports is showing signs of progress. Foreign buyers are snapping up everything from pork chops to airplanes with the Made in the USA label, and that means more jobs for American farmers and manufacturers. But analysts say it will take a more aggressive push to meet the president's goal of doubling exports within 5 years. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
President Obama's export initiative has a simple logic. 95% of the world's customers live outside the United States. So when this country is looking high and low for new job opportunities, it can't afford to ignore those overseas markets.
But this isn't just about where jobs are today. This is where American jobs will be tomorrow.
Export-related jobs are particularly attractive to the president because they don't depend on this country's already overextended consumers. Mr. Obama has vowed not to return to the old cycles of boom, bust, borrow, and spend. Trade Representative Ron Kirk is the president's point man on exports. Kirk says the administration's efforts aim to create some 2 million U.S. jobs over the next 5 years.
This is stimulus that we don't have to budget for. This is a way to grow the economy and put Americans back to work by continuing to show leadership in liberalizing trade around the world.
In recent months, the president's export push has scored some concrete gains. Negotiators persuaded China to reopen its market to U.S. pork and convinced Russia to start buying U.S. chickens again. The Export-Import Bank has doubled financing to encourage foreign sales, and the Commerce Department has sponsored trade missions for more than 160 U.S. companies.
And we're going to go to bat for everyone from the largest corporations to the smallest business owner with an idea that she wants to market and sell to the world.
In the first 4 months of this year, exports were up by 17%, but that barely matches the level of exports before the recession. Today, the president named 18 new members to an advisory export council, including CEO Scott Davis of UPS. Davis would love to see more cardboard boxes filling the backs of his company's big brown trucks.
For every 22 packages that crosses a border creates another UPS job. So trade does create jobs in this country and around the world.
UPS and other shipping companies are actually helping to identify American firms that already export to just one other country. The thinking is, with a little encouragement, they might be able to do more.
So it's essential that we educate the small and medium-sized enterprises about that opportunity, and then to help them actually do the exporting.
Dartmouth economist Matthew Slaughter applauds these moves, but he says doubling exports will require bigger changes in U.S. trade policy. Last month, Mr. Obama said he's hoping to revive a long-stalled free trade agreement with South Korea. Today, he suggested trade deals with Colombia and Panama could also come off the back burner. Slaughter, who was an advisor to former President George W. Bush, says those moves are bound to be more controversial than simply acting as an export cheerleader.
Americans have long been ambivalent about greater global engagement for the U.S. economy, and that's with good reason. Trade and other forms of globalization tend to generate very large gains for the United States overall, but those gains don't always accrue to every single worker and firm and community.
President Obama himself often sounded ambivalent about trade during the Democratic primary campaign. Departing from his prepared text today, he said he hopes to escape what he calls a false political debate.
The argument was either you were pro-trade or you were anti-trade. What we now have an opportunity to do is to refocus our attention where we're all in it together.
The president says he'll continue to press for a level playing field. In competing for jobs with other countries, he says, the U.S. can't play for second place. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Let's talk soccer now. The final matchup is set. Spain will face the Netherlands on Sunday for the 2010 World Cup. Spain beat Germany today by a score of 1-0. Yesterday, the Dutch dispatched Uruguay to earn their spot in the championship game. NPR's Mike Pesca is with us now. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
And what was the key to Spain's win today?
If I told you all the statistics of the game but not the final score and you knew anything about soccer, as I know you do, you would look at that sheet and say, well, Spain will have had to have won. They took more shots. They absolutely dominated possession, meaning the Germans, even though they're a counterattacking team and they don't mind if the other team has the ball a little more, Spain had the ball so much more that you would say, well, of course Spain won. But Spain has this penchant for not winning by a lot. They've won every game in the knockout stage by the exact same score, 1-0. And that was the score of the game, 1-0. And the other thing I would say, point to, when there's a bad call, when a goal is disallowed, everyone could point to that exact moment and say that was the thing. What happened in this game that really hurt Germany was Thomas Müller, one of their best players, was not allowed to play. And it was due to a bad referee call the game before, a handball that he shouldn't have been yellow carded for. So it's less easy to point to that exactly and say that was the exact reason, but it really had a big impact and hurt the German counterattack.
Well, the Spanish will face the Dutch on Sunday, and tell us what the Dutch bring to that match, apart from those great orange uniforms.
Aranya, yeah. They have a great history, but a lot of people look at the current Dutch team and they say, even though historically the Netherlands plays a system called total football, which basically means in shorthand, any player can play any position. This Dutch team doesn't really do that, but they have a lot of talented offensive players, a lot of guys who could put the ball in the net a lot of different ways. So although the Cognoscenti are maybe saying the Dutch aren't gelling quite like the Spanish are, they have won every single game. They've only trailed by about 40 minutes the entire World Cup. Well, they went behind Brazil early. But the fact that they came back to beat Brazil, which was the number one team in the FIFA rankings, bodes well for their chances. And the number two team in the FIFA rankings was Spain.
One thing we know is that there will be a first-time World Cup champion because neither Spain nor the Netherlands has won before.
It is a pretty tight rotation about which teams get to be and which countries get to be World Cup champions. Italy and Brazil, if you want to look at it that way, don't like to share the honor with others. And it's also the first time since 1978 when Argentina played the Netherlands that we have two teams playing each other, neither one of which have won a World Cup. The Dutch are known as the best soccer nation never to have won a World Cup. And Spain right now pretty much look like just the best soccer nation.
And it's the first time that there will be a European champion in a World Cup not played in Europe. I
appreciate
that. Yes,
they normally have the home continent advantage, yes.
Here's your big opportunity. You want to make a prediction in the final game?
Well, I know I looked that Ladbrokes, the English broker, says Spain should win by about 2-1. That sounds about right with me. Unless, and I'm going to throw this out there, if LeBron James tomorrow, in his announcement, announces he'll be playing for the Netherlands, I think that could put them over the top.
Okay, Mike, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
That's NPR's Mike Pesca in New York. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. Coast Guard Admiral Thad Allen, the man in charge of supervising the Gulf oil spill, says BP's capacity to collect oil from the blown-out well could double by this weekend if the weather cooperates. A vessel called the Helix has been delayed by bad weather for more than a week already. When it's operational, it should be able to collect up to 25,000 barrels of oil a day. I spoke with BP Chief Operating Officer Doug Suttles earlier today about the company's latest cleanup plan.
The current forecast is for the vessel to start up this weekend. What it will do is it'll take our capacity to recover oil from 25,000 barrels a day to 50,000 barrels a day. So that'll essentially double what we can capture now.
The numbers, Mr. Suttles, are interesting here because, of course, BP at the outset of the explosion said that the gusher was 1,000 barrels a day, then moved it up to 5,000. The government now saying it's 60,000 barrels a day. How do you reconcile the number that you are collecting and projected to collect with the estimates, the early estimates of what how much oil was coming out of this well?
Yeah, Melissa. I think if you go back in time, one of the things we've all said, the Coast Guard, ourselves, NOAA, everyone has said, is it's extremely difficult to know how much oil is coming out of this well. And the reasons for that is we can't put a person down there. We can't meter it. The techniques being used, and there's many, in particular by the government's FRTG group, are wide, but even their estimates, every time they look at it, they tend to have to adjust those because of those challenges.
But Mr. Suttles, there were scientists early on who estimated a flow rate of exactly what it's turning out to be right now. It wasn't hard to do, and it didn't take a long time.
Well, I don't think we know what it is right now. We know it's above 25,000 barrels a day. That's clear because that's the amount we're capturing today. I think if you look back, first of all, it was the Unified Command who always put out estimates, and these were numbers we got our folks together with theirs, with Coast Guard, NOAA, and others, and said at the time, this is our best estimate. What's important to look at, though, is how does it affect the response? And I can tell you from the beginning, all of us have essentially gone flat out. We actually looked at this thing and said, this is a terrible event, and it's critical that we apply every resource we can find to this problem, and we've done that. So the response wasn't predicated on what that estimate of the flow rate was.
I'm confused, though. If you had gone flat out, why weren't these vessels in place long ago? Why is the Helix just now getting hooked up, and how much of that was a real underestimation of how much oil was coming out of that well and what you thought you'd need in terms of resources?
Well, what we've done with all of the containment options is we've been bringing in the resources, the assets, the equipment as fast as we could get it. These things were not in the area. They've had to have major work to make them work. We've had to do things like install things on the seabed, build floating riser systems, and we've been doing these things as quickly as we can. In fact, after we finish the Helix Producer, we have more vessels we're going to have ready both to hook up and to have as redundancy and backup in the system. So we've been working that as fast as we could. It wasn't actually that we thought the rate was a certain amount and therefore we had enough.
Do you understand, though, Mr. Suttles, the concern from people who say that BP has minimized the extent of what's going on in the Gulf and has not responded quickly enough, was caught flat-footed here?
Well, you know, I clearly hear that a lot, and I understand the frustrations with that. But if you look at what we've done here, I mean, just today we have 45,000 people working on this. We have almost 6,000 vessels. We've spent over $3.2 billion so far. I mean, I think this shows the level of commitment to getting this thing fixed as fast as we can, to responding in the right way. I mean, no one's ever done anything close to this before, and we've been going at this thing flat out since the beginning.
You did, though, make projections even before the explosion of the well. In a filing with federal regulators back in March, BP said it could skim and remove nearly 500,000 barrels of oil every day if there were to be a major spill. And in fact, now more than 2 months after the explosion, you're about 37 million barrels short of that. How do you explain that huge discrepancy in what you said you could do and what you've actually done?
Well, you know, Melissa, I think once this event is finished, there will be so many things people look back on and say, what have we learned and what do we need to do differently? At the moment, you can imagine, and the people out here in the Gulf Coast, I think, want me to work on the problem I have right now, which is how do I actually clean this thing up as quickly as I can? How do I mitigate the damages? So it's a good question, but I think that the important point right now is what do I do to minimize these impacts? What do I do to collect the oil offshore? What do I do when it gets ashore to make sure we clean it up as quickly as possible?
Is it fair to say that promise of what you could do was wildly off?
Well, I don't know. What I can tell you is, though, is when this spill is done, the capability of the industry and the government to respond to something like this will be very different than it was on the day it started. I mean, we're not only fighting the spill with the tools that were available to us at the time. We've been adding and trying new things constantly. I mean, many people are familiar with the supertanker concept, which the test is being completed today. We're launching a whole new skimmer system on Thursday, tomorrow, and those things will be available to the world, to the industry, after this event's finished.
That's BP's Chief Operating Officer Doug Suttles talking with me from New Orleans. And tomorrow we'll have the second part of my interview with Mr. Suttles. We'll talk about the company's financial viability.
Before he became an award-winning novelist, David Mitchell lived in Japan as a young man teaching English. To write his latest novel, The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, Mitchell returned to Japan for 4 years and did historical research in the Netherlands. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says all that legwork paid off.
The critical word on David Mitchell is that he walks on water. Mitchell's first novel, written before he turned 30, was called Ghostwritten. And like his more recent triumph, Cloud Atlas, it's the kind of multi-stranded, intertextual narrative that automatically gets the label experimental slapped on it. Now his latest novel, called The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet, swerves into the traditional realm of historical fiction. The reader reaction so far has been ecstatic, I think partly because the suspicion lingers that experimental fiction may be too heavy on gimmickry and rather light on story and substance. For a postmodern wunderkind like Mitchell to pull off a straightforward, old-fashioned tale like this one is akin to that perhaps apocryphal story about Michelangelo auditioning before the Pope for the job of painting the Sistine Chapel by drawing a perfect circle, freehand. Far be it from me to give the creatively buoyant Mitchell a dunking in the reviewer's vat of vinegar, though I do have one small brackish water balloon to lob. Overall, The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet is a beautiful novel, full of life and authenticity, atmosphere, and characters that breathe. It manages to do what the best historical fiction always does, make a reader melancholy, thinking about all those other true life stories from the past that have melted into air. You know right off this is going to be an extraordinary novel because of its setting. The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet opens in 1799 on an island called Dejima in the harbor of Nagasaki, Japan. As our title hero, Jacob de Zoet, first describes it, the fan-shaped island is man-made, some 200 paces long around its outer curve, and erected, like much of Amsterdam, on sunken piles. Dejima is the province of the Dutch East Indies Company, and its tiny stone bridge over a tidal moat constitutes the sole gateway between samurai-ruled Japan and the outside world. Young Jacob has arrived there to serve 5 years as a bookkeeper, after which he hopes to have amassed enough money to marry the wealthy fiancée waiting for him back in Amsterdam. This island outpost of progress is packed with spies, prostitutes, sailors, slaves, and con men. It's a sliver of the feverish modern world ruled by commerce, wedged up against resolute feudalism. Pious Jacob withstands the usual temptations, but falls hard for a young Japanese woman he meets cute when she runs into his warehouse chasing an ape carrying a severed human leg. I'll skip the explanation. Mitchell revels in, among other things, exuberantly screwball plot twists. Instead, I'll simply say that the woman, Orito Ibagawa, is a midwife whose face was partly disfigured in an accident involving hot oil. She's a wonderful, wry creation, but, and here comes my only criticism of Mitchell's otherwise superb novel, when Miss Ibagawa's adventures take over in book two, the novel mutates into a gothic pastiche, complete with supernatural villain, blood sacrifices, and a labyrinthine prison. Mitchell apparently can do everything when it comes to fiction writing, but he should have resisted this detour into the land of twilight. Fortunately, it's a wrong turn that soon righted. Mitchell's chameleon-like gifts as a novelist are on display everywhere else here, in pages-long drunken conversations over cards, in the delicate negotiations between the Japanese hosts and their Dutch business partners, and in the fabulous action scenes. This is a novel in which we're treated to an earthquake, a typhoon, and a naval battle worthy of Horatio Hornblower. It's the reveries, though, of the exile Jacob de Zoet that make the most indelible impressions. At a decisive moment in the novel, Jacob runs after Miss Ibagawa to tell her he loves her. He's propelled to make this outrageous declaration, we're told, by the inner whisperings of the ghost of future regret. What a wonderful phrase, the ghost of future regret. The same ghost that should be whispering in your ear right now if you have any doubts about reading this strange and singular novel.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Thousand Autumns of Jacob de Zoet by David Mitchell. You can read an excerpt of the book on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Lauren Krenzel. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Alyssa Block. The nation's two largest teachers' unions are holding their annual conventions this week, and they have some pretty harsh things to say about the Obama administration's education agenda. Some teachers are even calling for Education Secretary Arne Duncan to resign. The unions support many of the administration's proposals, but as NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports, their relationship with the administration has begun to sour.
If Education Secretary Arne Duncan is worried about the angry rhetoric coming from the presidents of the National Education Association and American Federation of Teachers, he certainly won't admit it.
I just have huge respect for them as individuals. I know they have very, very challenging jobs, but I think they are the right leaders at the right time.
The feeling is not mutual among NEA delegates meeting in New Orleans. Earlier this week, they called for Duncan's resignation and cast a vote of no confidence in the administration's school reform agenda. For good reason, says NEA President Dennis Van Roekel. Instead of overhauling the politically unpopular No Child Left Behind law, Van Roekel says the Obama administration has not done enough to rescind the law's worst features.
The narrowing of the curriculum, the overemphasis on tests, the labeling and the punishment of districts is not working, and the students are losing.
So here's how the administration can get back on the union's good side, says Van Roekel. Reward schools for raising kids' academic performance, no matter how small. Stop relying on tests as a single measure of students' academic growth. And absolutely stop supporting the use of test scores to evaluate teachers or decide how much they should be paid.
I think that decision is best made at the local level, not mandated and micromanaged from the federal level.
If the administration does not rethink its policy, says Van Roekel, it'll find itself on a collision course with teachers and their unions. Which is not entirely a bad thing, says Margaret Spellings, former Secretary of Education in the Bush administration.
I do think there are some political advantages in characterizing the unions as about the status quo, and I would commend the president and the secretary for some of the stances that they've taken are very courageous for a Democrat to take, and I would not characterize them as anti-teacher. I would characterize them as pro-student.
That's inside the Beltway politics, says Randy Weingarten, president of the American Federation of Teachers. The real question is, can this administration work with teachers to push fair and meaningful reforms?
You can't do it without listening to the voices of teachers. That's part of why you hear the anger in my voice, because to demonize them and scapegoat them or their unions will end up a failed policy.
Some say this growing rift, however, could further weaken teachers' unions more than it does President Obama.
The political power of teacher unions is vastly overrated right now.
That's Joe Williams, head of Democrats for Education Reform. He says the AFT and NEA are angry because the president hasn't pandered to teachers' unions.
You can look back at the president as a candidate speaking before the unions, making it clear about his support for charter schools, his support for things like performance pay. It was not a closeted agenda. For people to act right now like they feel betrayed by this president only suggests they were not paying attention when he was speaking.
Williams and others agree. In the face of growing union opposition, the Obama administration will have to look to business leaders and civil rights groups to anchor a new political coalition to get things done. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.